Our next case is 13-283. It is Sharon A. Sauer et al. Versus Stinson J. Cruz et al. Sitting in place of Justice French is Judge Patrick DeWine from the First District. Welcome, Judge DeWine. For the appellant, Mr. Garner.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, Judge DeWine, counsel. May it please the court. I represent the appellant, Century Surety Company, in this case. This is a case, an insurance coverage action appeal involving a standard commercial general liability policy with an automobile liability exclusion in it, and whether or not that policy applies to a fatal traffic accident involving a commercial trailer registered and principally garaged in Ohio and owned by the appellees Stinson J. Cruz and Stinson Cruz Trucking, which I'll refer to as Cruz throughout the argument and throughout our brief, was run into by another vehicle operated by Julia Augenstein, who unfortunately died in that accident. Ms. Augenstein is not a party to this appeal. We've been joined in asking for the lower courts to be reversed by this court by amici, both the Ohio Insurance Institute and the Ohio Association of Civil Trial Attorneys, because of the important insurance issues raised in this case. And we are asking this court to reverse the lower courts, to enter judgment for Century, finding that there is no insurance coverage under this CGL policy for this auto accident for three reasons. First, because the trailer is indisputably and expressly and specifically defined as an auto under the Century policy such that it would be subject to the automobile liability exclusion. Second, despite what the lower courts and Cruz have argued, there are no exceptions to this exclusion. In particular, it cannot fall under the mobile equipment exception found in the CGL policy because this trailer was indisputably subject to Ohio's financial responsibility laws and therefore by definition cannot fall within the definition of what an auto is. And finally, when the Century policy is considered in context, we would submit to this court that there are no ambiguities in this particular policy that could be construed in such a way as to reach the results reached by the lower courts in this case.
When you say that when it's considered in context, there's no ambiguity, that seems to suggest that a plain reading or a quick reading of it would be contrary to that.
This is one of the central issues that we deal with, and one of the things that I think has been the driving force behind one of these cases is how this court will deal with interpretive devices to deal with the issue of ambiguity in any contract, not just with insurance policies. And one of the difficulties we have is when we use these interpretive devices, when sometimes we'll come up with conclusions where we look at this and we say, you know, I really don't think the parties ever really would have contracted to do this. You come up with an unreasonable result. So, in this particular case, what the 10th Appellate District did was to take sort of a legal abstraction and to take this word cargo and take it out of context and say, you know, in different contexts, it can mean different things. Well, we don't have any argument with the fact that in different contexts, it can mean different things. But what we're suggesting to the court and what we've argued to the court is that in order for us to do what is paramount in contract interpretation, which is to try and determine the intent of the parties based upon the language used in the policy, we have to look at the context of the particular contract in order to understand whether or not I'm just dealing with a legal abstraction or whether or not I'm dealing with something which is really relevant to the parties in this particular case.
If you look at ambiguity as meaning two reasonable ways of seeing what the language means, and you're saying that you need to go beyond the actual words into other parts of the contract to see if there's ambiguity. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, I think you and I may be talking apples and apples, Justice Landsinger, because the key word, I think, in the question you just asked me was two reasonable interpretations. And we would both agree that if I take a word out of context and I say it means something, when in fact, in context, it really means exactly the opposite or something different. You would agree with me, I think, that that is unreasonable. And one of the examples that I've used before when I've argued in this court on different issues and ambiguity is, if I took the word offsides, it has one meaning in soccer, it has a different meaning in football. If I read a document that talks about strikers and forwards and corner kicks and throw-ins, I'm pretty clear that I'm talking about the word offsides in soccer. But if I start talking about linebackers and wide receivers and touchdowns and so forth, then I think we're pretty clear that I'm talking about offsides as it applies to in football. And it would not be reasonable to take a document that talked about that and say, I'm going to apply the soccer definition of offsides to what clearly is a football document, simply because in the abstract, I could say that these two words, if I pull them out of a dictionary, or this word could have two different meanings if I pull them out of a dictionary, because almost every single word in the English language has multiple definitions depending upon the context in which it is used. So I think we're saying the same thing. I'm not suggesting that there's something extra. What I'm saying is that if we draw anything from our second proposition of law, what we would draw would be this. What is paramount whenever we do contract interpretation is the intent of the parties. And if we are not reaching something which appears to be the intent of the parties, then we should be looking at that interpretive device and saying, I'm not sure that we're there. That's what this court did in the Graham versus Dry Dock case, which was a mining case. That's what this court did in the Galatis case. That's what this court did in the Davison case. In each one of those cases, the court said it was perfectly proper to use interpretive devices to try and ascertain the intent of the parties. But if we reach a conclusion using that interpretive device that is unreasonable or is unusual or is highly unlikely to be what the parties actually agreed to, then we have to look at that interpretive device, whether it be the dictionary, whether it be the rule of contra profferentum, whether it be some other rule that we would normally use, such as a general over a specific, or a specific over a general, excuse me. We have to look at that rule and we have to say, this helps us get closer perhaps, but it doesn't get us to where we need to be because we're somewhere where the intent of the parties probably is unlikely from using this rule.
And then we don't have to go into the reading the language most strictly against the drafter.
You could do that if, in fact, we're in a situation where there was really a question. I think, I can't remember the case, it's not in our briefs or anything, but in law school, I remember there was a case that started off that the meaning of this case depends upon what the meaning of the word chicken is. And there was a question as to whether or not it was, you know, chicken parts of this kind or chicken parts of that kind. And in that kind of a context where it isn't defined, I think you begin to say, okay, you had someone that drafted this contract. If you do, in fact, have an equal bargaining power, you could probably use the rule of contra profferentum to say, you weren't specific here. And so we're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the non-drafting party. In this particular case, we may get to contra profferentum, and we don't argue with that. As an insurance company, we draft the policies. If there really is a reasonable ambiguity in the policy, then we get to a situation where we say, okay, it gets construed against us. But in this particular case, I asked this court, which is one of the final things we had, of what relevance is it whether or not the items carried on Cruz's trailer were for sale or not?
Well, counsel, let me see if I understand your argument. You're suggesting that the truck that the trailer was attached to was an insured vehicle, correct?
It may have been under the Progressive policy, but no, I wasn't going down that path at all. But before I answer and continue along, I'd like to have you develop that some more because maybe you're going somewhere different than.
Well, we didn't start with that. There's an insurance policy and it provides coverage for something, and let's just suggest, so I understand your theory, if the trailer was attached to the truck and they were going down the road and they changed lanes inadvertently and the trailer hit a car, do we have an uninsured moment at that point?
No. In this particular case, we're talking about two different policies then, Justice O'Neill. What we'd be talking about is we did have a commercial auto policy issued by Progressive in this that we believe and have argued in our brief would have provided coverage regardless of whether or not the trailer was listed on that policy because of various regulatory forms on there. We believe that that would be covered under the circumstances. The question here is a commercial general liability policy, does it provide coverage under those circumstances? And the answer is no. It'd be like if you were in an auto accident and instead of pursuing your automobile liability policy to defend you, you went to your homeowner's policy and said, I'd like you to defend me for whatever reason that decision was made here because there is an automobile liability exclusion with some minor little exception like parking a car or something like that, and therefore I'd like to be defended under that policy. Now, I think the setup is fairly simple then otherwise, if you begin to look at this policy. The exclusion actually is on page 9 of our brief, and it's listed in the supplement at page 46. This insurance does not apply to bodily injury arising out of the ownership, maintenance, use, or entrustment to others of any auto owned or operated by or rented or loaned to any insured. The policy also expressly defines what an auto is, and that's in our merit brief at page 9 and in the supplement at page 52. And an auto is expressly defined to include a trailer. It also goes on and says that it includes any vehicle that's subject to a compulsory financial responsibility law. However, and this is where the lower courts, I believe, lost their way. said an auto does not include mobile equipment. So the lower courts and Cruz went to the definition of mobile equipment, and they said this trailer might be mobile equipment. And they looked through all the definitions of mobile equipment, and they said, well, this doesn't apply, and this doesn't apply, and this doesn't apply, and this doesn't apply, and this doesn't apply. But look, there's this catch-all at the very bottom. This catch-all is very broad, and it says vehicles, it's F, paragraph F in the definition. It says vehicles not described in A, B, C, or D above, maintained primarily for purposes other than the transportation of persons or cargo. And then they focused in the abstract on what this word cargo might mean in different contexts and said it could mean different things in different contexts, and therefore there's an ambiguity. We'll resolve that in favor of coverage. What they ignored, which is right in the exact same definition, is the following language, which comes right after that, that says, however, mobile equipment does not include any land vehicle that's subject to compulsory financial responsibility law or any other motor vehicle insurance law in the state where it's licensed or principally garaged. And then to paraphrase, it goes on with another sentence that says these vehicles will be considered autos. It is undisputed in this case that this trailer was registered with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. And in our merit, that's at 226 in the supplement, which actually has the abstract of the BMV registration for this particular trailer. And at paragraphs 2 to 3 of our brief, what we do is we lay out the regulatory provisions for commercial vehicles, for commercial trailers. And I'm not going to go through all those unless the court wants to talk about those, but what those regulatory provisions, both administrative code sections and statutes, demonstrate is that this trailer was subject to Ohio's financial responsibility laws, which is, Justice O'Neill, going back to your question, exactly what we would expect and want for any kind of commercial vehicle being moved upon our highways, because we want the motoring public to be safe from things, from these trailers changing lanes or things falling off these trailers or other things happening like that. So as a result, what we see is that this trailer could not ever be considered mobile equipment under the express definition set forth in the Century policy. So the result reached by the lower courts was incorrect. Now, Cruz does not dispute this. What they say is, we waive the argument because we didn't raise it this way in the lower court. And we respectfully suggest, no, the issue of whether or not the automobile liability exclusion applies and whether or not this was an auto or whether this was mobile equipment, and all the definitions we just talked about were fully engaged in the lower court. The fact that there's some different nuance that's argued in the Supreme Court versus being argued in the lower courts because of the way the lower courts ruled, it doesn't mean that the issue's been waived. It just means that the lower courts didn't focus on that particular part of the issue. And so the Ohio case law is very clear that we can bring this issue to the court's attention and say, time out. This wasn't supposed to work out this way. We weren't even supposed to get into all this abstraction about what cargo means or doesn't mean, because we never get there.
So you talked about the lack of attempt to have Progressive brought in, and the fact that this was a vehicle that was should have been covered under the Progressive policy in the lower courts.
That's correct. And in fact, there was motions for summary judgment that were filed by Progressive in the lower court arguing why they didn't have coverage. Ultimately, Cruz entered into a consent judgment entry with Progressive saying, we agree you don't have coverage, so the issue was never formally litigated in the sense of a back-and-forth adversarial setting because they agreed with Progressive. We didn't agree with them.
What was your relationship with Progressive in the lawsuit?
Progressive is just another carrier. They're the commercial auto carrier, and Century Surety Company is the CGL carrier. So it's like, again, going back to the commentary I had with Justice O'Neill, it's like the difference between your homeowner's policy and your auto policy.
What you're really asking us to do is correct the error of the Court of Appeals, aren't you?
No, I don't think so.
Something for us to write in this case?
It is, and I think...
What is it that you want us to do that?
O'Donnell, I had a running bet with my associates that I would be asked that question by you, and I think that the proposition of law number...
Win?
Thank you. You saved me some
money. How much did you get?
The odds are tremendously in your favor.
Of the two, I have two propositions of law that we submitted, both of which are the rules that we're asking this court to write. The first one is a very specific dealing with the trailer. The second one, though, I think is what's critical, and it goes back to what Justice Lanziger and I were talking about, which is I believe that part of the reason why the Court of Appeals got lost is because Ohio law has not clarified the issue of how these interpretive devices get used when we're trying to ascertain the intent of the parties. And when we're dealing with a highly regulated area such as commercial vehicles moving on highways, context is critical. And so we're asking this court to put on in propositional law number two to make clear, to reiterate to the lower courts that that these issues need to be considered in context and not to do some legal abstraction.
It occurs to me that this is simple contract interpretation where it says mobile equipment does not include a land vehicle, and land vehicles subject to compulsory or financial responsibility are considered autos. I mean, it's pretty much interpretation of the language of a contract is what you're asking us to do.
With respect to winning the case, absolutely. With respect to looking at what the 10th Appellate District did and said and what the impact could be on other cases, and the reason why OII and OACTA got involved in these cases, the reason why is because of the way the interpretive device, the use of the dictionary definition, was used in this case. That's going to create problems not only in this case, but in other cases with respect to legal abstractions, to invent ambiguities that don't really exist under the circumstances. So the rule of law, proposition of law number two, Justice O'Donnell, is the one that we think is critical in this case.
So put most generally, it would be when considering whether ambiguity exists, the court must look to the context. Basically, that's what you're asking.
That's correct, Justice Lanziger. And if you look at the cases that we relied upon in our brief, most of them get to be fairly old. We're 30, 40, 50 years old. So there hasn't been a pronouncement by this court in the recent past that has said, look, we've got all these rules we've used. This is what we're concerned about in contracts. We need to determine the intent of the parties.
Did you say this has been written 30 years ago?
I'm sorry?
Did you say this has been written by this court 30 years ago?
There have been a number of decisions that have said these kinds of things, correct.
Which one would you reference to us?
Oh, the Beaubier case is one of the cases that we have where it says that it has to be considered in context, and if it has a technical meaning that has been acquired, that technical meaning should be used.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Dingus.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I would like to begin by addressing Justice O'Neill's question about whether the truck or the trailer, if it was attached to the truck, would have been insured. The answer to that question is yes. If the trailer itself had been attached to the truck, the Progressive policy provided that it would be an insured vehicle. The reason that it wasn't insured under the Progressive policy is because it wasn't attached. So basically what we have there is an unattached piece of equipment that is uninsured, essentially, if you buy into Century's argument. Neither the Progressive policy would insure it, nor would the Century policy insure it. It would simply be something sitting there on the roadway, not subject to any financial responsibility.
Is there case law to support that kind of an interpretation for the Progressive coverage, that because the trailer was not attached to the tractor at the time of the accident, although it was transported there by the trailer, it was left there by the tractor, and because the tractor detached, because it was not moving, that takes it out of the coverage of Progressive?
I know of no case law. What I am relying on is the contract itself with Progressive. The contract with Progressive itself specifically excluded the trailer if it was not attached. So we have situations where it would be insured if it was attached, but the policy specifically excluded it if it was not attached. So I don't think we need to rely on case law in that manner.
Because is that contract in the record?
It is. It should be in the record because the progressive policy arguments have been made by Century. I've never really raised them because I didn't believe there was coverage under it because of the specific exclusion. So it wasn't up to me to raise that issue. On that issue as well, I will mention that in Century's reply brief, Century argues that Cruz had the burden to prove that there was an ambiguity or that the exception to exclusion applies. That is not the law in this court. The law of this court is that any time in an insurance contract where an insurance company seeks to apply an exclusion, the insurer bears the burden of proving that exclusion, not the insured. the insurer, and that's in the Continental Insurance versus Lewis Marks Company case. So they had the burden to prove that in the lower court. Their argument now is that, well, there was an additional part of the policy that wasn't addressed in the lower court. Well, it was Century's burden to bring that issue up to the court, to make that a legal basis, and part of their argument in the lower court, and they didn't do so, to rely on evidence in the record. The evidence in the record is the, I'm sorry, Justice Lasinger?
I was going to ask you, maybe I didn't understand what you just said. Did you say that an exception to an exclusion in the policy must be proven by the insurer?
No. The if there is an exclusion in a policy, that must be proven
right,
by the insurer.
But I think originally you said the exception to the exclusion. So not the exception to the exclusion would be just the opposite.
If I did, I misspoke.
Okay.
My understanding of the argument is that Century is making is that Cruz would be required to prove that the exclusion did not apply versus Century proving that it did apply. And that is the law of this court. With respect to that particular argument, because it was not raised in the lower court and it was not addressed, this court should not address it.
What if we don't buy your waiver argument? Do you concede, as they say, that this trailer was covered by the financial responsibility law?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer, and here's why. I'll be honest, I have been unable to connect the dots that Century cites in its brief to show that the trailer itself was subject to financial responsibility laws. I've been unable to connect the dots. I mean, it's a commercial
trailer. Is it licensed?
It's
through the BMV.
It's
licensed through the BMV? Well, then isn't my understanding of the Bureau of Motor Vehicle requires all licensed vehicles to be insured or produce financial responsibility?
Well, the provision that Century relies on only says that if you're a private motor carrier in Ohio, you must show proof of insurance. It doesn't say you must show proof of insurance on every vehicle or piece of equipment that you own that is possibly registered with the BMV. All it says is that you must have insurance. It doesn't, I read no portion of the statute that Century cited or any of the regulations that stand for the proposition that you must insure every piece of equipment and every
vehicle. Well, I think it's registered and licensed is the distinction here. You can register the ownership, have a title to something, but it's not on the road, so it doesn't have to be licensed. If it's on the road and it's in operation, my understanding is it has to be licensed.
And Century, I do not believe, presented that law in its brief that shows that. The law that they presented, I have been unable to connect the dots there. I just have been unable to, I reviewed those statutes, I reviewed the administrative code, I've been unable to connect the dots. So in response to the question, yes, I mean, if all of those things happen, I do believe there could be a problem. I'll concede that. But that was not argued. There was no opportunity to argue that below. And I think that, again, that argument needed to be made below because of that particular issue. It's because, well, is it registered? And because it is registered, is it subject to financial responsibility? That was never addressed below. And so it's not part of the record, in a sense. As far as the ambiguity itself is concerned, I think the lower court and the Court of Appeals correctly found that the term cargo is clearly susceptible to more than one interpretation. It can mean any item, but it could also mean a good or merchandise in the stream of commerce.
But you're not suggesting that we pick one word and then determine multiple meanings and say there's ambiguity, are you?
No. Absolutely not. All I'm saying is that this term is subject and susceptible to multiple interpretations. That's all I'm saying. Because it is susceptible to multiple interpretations makes it ambiguous. Right? It is clearly subject to more than one interpretation. You nearly just need to look at the dictionary definitions.
You don't think that context matters?
I think it matters, but I think in the context of any type of a general liability policy or liability policy involving any type of business, that it's not an unreasonable interpretation to interpret that term to mean goods or merchandise in the stream of commerce. I think it's well within the context of that. And common sense tells me that if you were to look at the term cargo, I don't think the first thing you would think of is anything, you know, any item you're transporting. If you're transporting some sporting equipment in the back of your car in a bin, I don't think anybody's going to consider that to be cargo. I think, what cargo do you have in your car? I don't think there's such sporting equipment. If there's a train that's going along with you while you're transporting this that's carrying crude oil, that's cargo. Any item that's meant to be sold is cargo. I think those are all reasonable interpretations. And because it's ambiguous, then it must be strictly construed against Century, and it must be liberally construed in favor of Cruise. So therefore, if you were to look at the policy and read it as mobile equipment meaning a trailer transporting any good or merchandise, a stream of commerce, that doesn't fit here. And the exclusion would not apply, which would result in coverage. And I think that's basically the argument or the decision of the lower court. It's been my argument and also in the appellate court. I don't think that's an unreasonable interpretation at all of that. I don't think also that it's a legal abstraction to refer and rely on the dictionary, including the Black's Law Dictionary. I don't think those are abstractions at all. As far as as well with respect to the policy arguments made in the briefs, specifically with respect to amicus curiae. As I kind of call it, sky is falling brief. If you uphold this contract and interpret it this way, these courts could be inundated with these type of cases. First and foremost, this case I think could be limited somewhat to the facts. I mean, this is a very, very unusual set of circumstances. It's not something you see every day where there's a trailer parked in the roadway and a driver drives over multiple cones and crashes into the rear and dies as a result. I think that is a bit unusual.
So you don't think that we need to write on Proposition 2 here regarding ambiguity? In construing ambiguity, you look to context of the agreement?
Yes, I think you should look to the context of the agreement. But again, I don't think it's out of context to include the interpretation of cargo meaning goods or merchandise in the stream of commerce. I don't think that's out of context of the contract itself. But with respect to the policy considerations, I think that's an easy fix for the insurance companies in this case. You know, if they don't want to insure these type of incidents, well, they can delete the language, they can define the term, or they can use a different term or phrase in the policy. That's a very simple fix. For instance, had Century included the phrase any term or any item in place of cargo, I don't think there would have been an ambiguity at all. It would clearly be anything, any item that was being transported on the trailer. That was not the case. The insurer is the one who chose the language, who chose the policy, who chose the provisions. Cruise didn't. He's obviously not an expert in...
Counsel, this is probably late in your argument to ask you this question,
sure.
But should we reverse? I'm joining Justice O'Donnell. I'm not sure what we can write, but should we reverse the Court of Appeals? Where is insurance coverage in this tragic accident? Is it an uninsured event at that point as to the trailer?
I simply don't think there is any insurance coverage. I have not really given that too much thought, but based on my I've been in this case since pretty much the beginning. There is no insurance. I mean, this is the policy. Again, like I said earlier, the progressive policy, and we initially thought would apply, but because of the specific exclusion, does not apply. So I don't think there would be insurance, and I'm not sure there would be an uninsured motorist claim. I think there could be probably some argument from an insurer that they, it would be an uninsured motorist claim because it's not necessarily a customary vehicle.
But to follow the Chief Justice's questions earlier, are you suggesting that if the tractor was attached to this trailer when it was parked there, there would be insurance, but if the tractor is not attached, there's no insurance?
That's correct, because the progressive policy specifically stated that if the trailer is attached, it is insured. If it's not attached, it's not insured. If there are no more questions, I thank you very much.
Thank you. Council, you used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The progressive policy that you're referring to, the separate policy, appears in the supplement at pages 239 to 328. Form F appears at page 244 of the supplement, which is the administrative form, Justice O'Neill, which would provide insurance coverage under the progressive policy regardless of whether it was attached to a truck or not. But then that would require reimbursement from Cruise.
So he says hot and you say cold?
I say, based upon the case law that we have in the brief, that the Form F is like the MCS 90 that this court has looked at, which is going to provide coverage regardless of whether or not the vehicle is listed, regardless of whether or not it's covered. It's a protective form for the public. It's on this policy, the progressive policy, to protect the public in intrastate trucking cases like this one. And we've laid, that's part of the reason why we laid all this out for the court. That's why we put the administrative code sections in there about insurance. That's why we put the stuff in there about Form F. It's not dispositive of the issue as to whether or not there's insurance coverage under the progressive policy, but your question goes back to sort of, what do we do in this situation? And the answer is, there was always coverage under the progressive policy. And in fact, the damages were only $250,000, and there was plenty of money. There was $350,000 available under the progressive policy. And for the life of me, I can't imagine why there was a consent judgment entry entered in the lower courts. The only other thing that I would add is, with respect to context, look at our brief at pages 16 to 21. Justice Lanzinger, we talk about the state and federal cargo securement regulations, no difference as to whether things are for sale or not. The PUCO safety handbook, no difference as to whether or not things are for sale. We have cases cited from the 3rd Appellate District in Ohio, the Northern District in Iowa, and the 8th Circuit, all of which say there's no difference between whether or not things are for sale or not when we're talking about these kinds of provisions. The only case law that was relied upon by the lower courts and by Cruise is case law interpreting the word cargo in the context of marine insurance policies, which are completely different contexts than this. There, the issue of whether or not something's for sale or not, whether it's pertinent to the ship or not, whether or not it should be considered part of the ship or whether it should be considered something different, there it makes a difference. And so there you look at that and you say, gee, I understand it might mean something different in a different context. That's not this context. Please reverse the lower courts. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you please call a recess?